The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
And now, The Trumpet Daily with Stephen Flurry.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. If you'd like to email the program this week, send those comments to td@kpcg.fm. And as always, we'll try to collect them as they come in and let you know what some of your fellow listeners are out there saying about this program. Today's show, we'll look back over this past weekend, some of the things that I was able to do with my family, a couple of things that I'll get into in the second segment, if we have time. There's a lot that I have packed into the first segment here, so we'll see. We'll see how it goes, but I'll definitely try to update you on the response to the program that played here in the UK over the weekend, the one in which we offered the new booklet, Great Again, so we had a really good response to that particular show. But of course, over the weekend, the big news was about Fidel Castro dying. I believe that was Saturday morning. And just the response to his death has been quite revealing, particularly when you see what kind of response Donald Trump's election got just a couple weeks ago, two, 3 weeks ago. Donald Trump, according to many Western observers and leaders, he's very divisive and dangerous. He, according to Barack Obama, is uniquely unqualified to serve as President of the United States. He's even temperamentally unfit to be Commander-in-Chief. And throughout the American presidential campaign, evidently Donald Trump showed utter contempt for the values that make America great. But now with Fidel Castro, well, this is an altogether different story. He is some kind of revolutionary leader. You look at the way the president responded with this written statement. He said that because of this, the United States, we want to extend a hand of friendship to the Cuban people. He said this, quote, "We know that this moment fills Cubans in Cuba and in the United States with powerful emotions, recalling the countless ways in which Fidel Castro altered the course of individual lives, families, and of the Cuban nation. Nothing about his fitness for office, this dictator that oppressed his people, nothing about him showing utter contempt for American values." Mr. Obama said, "History will record and judge the enormous impact of this singular figure on the people and world around him. We offer condolences to Fidel Castro's family, and our thoughts and prayers are with the Cuban people. In the days ahead," President Obama said, "they will recall the past and also look to the future. As they do, the Cuban people must know that they have a friend and partner in the United States of America." And of course, this president has reached out to Cuba and offered a hand of friendship and opened up all kinds of financial aid to the island nation of Cuba without asking for anything in return. Nothing in return. We'll get more into that in just a bit. But that was President Obama's response. The Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, his was even worse. He said, "It's with deep sorrow that I learned today of the death of Cuba's longest-serving president," his longest-serving president, because, of course, no one could challenge him. It says, "Fidel Castro was a larger-than-life leader who served his people." Two references to service. In the first two sentences, he was a servant, don't you know? A leader who served his people for almost half a century, a legendary revolutionary and orator. Look at these words. I mean, would he ever say this about Donald Trump or any other leader, for that matter? A revolutionary, a great orator, legendary. Mr. Castro made significant improvements to the education and health care of his island nation. And that's, of course, what all of the radical leftists are there promoting or spotlighting, that, well, it was education and health care. Just these fantastic advancements and improvements in education and health care. Trudeau says, while a controversial figure, both Mr. Castro's supporters and detractors recognized his tremendous dedication and love for the Cuban people. There's quite a few Cubans that would disagree with that. Tens of thousands of Cubans that would disagree with that. But according to Trudeau, there's so many of the Cuban people that just have this lasting affection for El Comandante. He says here, I know my father was very proud to call him a friend, and I had the opportunity to meet Fidel when my father passed away. It was also a real honor to meet his three sons and brother, President Raul Castro, during my recent visit to Cuba, on behalf of all Canadians, Prime Minister Trudeau says. Sophie and I offer our deepest condolences to the family, friends, and many, many supporters of Mr. Castro. We join the people of Cuba today in mourning the loss of this remarkable leader. That's how the Canadian Prime Minister responded to Fidel Castro's death on Saturday. Here in the UK, here's how Jeremy Corbyn reacted to Castro's death.
Castro has been such a huge figure in our lives. I remember the news in 1959, the day that he marched into Havana, having marched all the way from Sierra Maestra in the war there to bring about the Cuban Revolution. I remember the Cuban Missile Crisis and all the fear that was going on then. And I've visited Cuba a couple of three times, and indeed I've cycled around Cuba with one of my sons. And what's so impressive about Cuba is the education and the health services. And I think the legacy of Castro will be that, but will also be this enormous figure on the world stage, the one who campaigned against apartheid and the one who brought a different language and a different set of values. Latterly, things have changed a lot in Cuba. There is a greater recognition that economic progress must go hand in hand with improvements in human rights and the rights of free speech. There were problems, and there are problems, of excesses by all regimes, and I recognize that. I have spoken out against human rights abuses anywhere in the world, and indeed raised these issues anywhere in the world. But I think we have to look at the thing in its totality. I think history will show that Castro was such a key figure, and he's seen off a lot of US presidents. Remember, when he first became the president in Cuba, Eisenhower was the president of the USA, and we're now many, many presidents later, all of whom have pledged to get rid of Castro. None of them succeeded in doing so, and it's to the credit of both the Castros, Fidel and his younger brother, that they and President Obama reached an accord.
It's to their credit that they reached this accord. All these presidents, you know, the United States presidents that tried to get rid of him, they couldn't succeed. Castro stayed in there through all these administrations. And now look at what he and his brother were able to do in reaching out to President Obama. That's how some of the leaders in the United States and Britain have responded to Fidel Castro's death. The media, from the left-wing reporting, has been, again, just as atrocious. At the BBC, they had someone on, this was reported at the Telegraph, but they had someone on Saturday morning, Richard Gott, who was, he was there just praising Castro, like so many of the other commentators. And here this Gott fellow in 1994 was exposed as having taken money from the KGB. He was being paid by the KGB. And this is who the BBC rolls out to praise the passing of Fidel Castro. And of course the BBC leaves that little detail out about Richard Gott, the commentator, and just brings him on as an expert, a so-called expert, who talks about all of these things that he's going to be remembered for. Education and healthcare. Well, there were a few problems. There were a few excesses. And there are some human rights violations, but you know, those are pretty common here in the West as well. That's the thinking. The Telegraph says here, suppose that, well, it's talking about this Richard Gott and how he came on the BBC and praised Castro on Saturday. It says at the end of this Telegraph piece, suppose that covering the death of General Franco, Benito Mussolini, or any other right-wing dictator, the BBC had rustled up a comparable person to defend him and broadcast his views without explanation of this, the editor of the Today program would have been removed from his post the following morning. But with the case of a radical left-wing communist dictator, well, he certainly did help education and healthcare. And of course, these left-wing commentators and these left-wing leaders, they love the policies of socialism and communism, which gives so much power to the state. And so they're willing to turn a blind eye to all of these atrocities, and that's what they are. You need to go back and read that chapter in He Was Right. It's on page 46 of the version I have. The communist infiltration of America was prophesied. That's really what this reaction shows. It just shows how deep the roots are, the communist roots are, right in the United States, right in Canada, right in the UK. And you might say, well, these are the far left leaders that you're quoting from. Well, like one article I'll get into here in just a second, like it brings out, where are the statements coming from the right denouncing the rule? There's a few voices, but not very many. Well, either they support it tacitly or they just kind of keep their lips sealed, I guess. All of these radical leftists talking about Castro, of all people, in these kinds of terms, it's because they themselves love communism. And it shows just how rotten America and Britain are from within. The sickness. It shows how our nations have lost the pride in their power. Last week I went through that section in Leviticus 26 about all these curses that set in for disobedience. God says, if you don't obey my laws, then this is what's going to happen. You're going to lose the pride that you once had in your power, that you once had to speak out against evil empires, as Ronald Reagan often did. Now someone like this, Castro, he's seen as a revolutionary orator and leader. He's legendary. He's legendary, the Canadian Prime Minister says. Barack Obama, Jeremy Corbyn, all of them. This piece here in the Telegraph from a distinguished historian, Andrew Roberts. He said, Western leaders' cowardly refusal to condemn Fidel Castro brings shame upon our democracies. That's the real shame here. Look at what it says about our democracies. When you have all of these Western leaders refusing to condemn what that man did to his people for the past 60 some odd years, 70 years, and there's no change with the handover of power to his brother. No change whatsoever, as my father's written about at thetrumpet.com. It's the same old, same old. If anything, they've tightened their grip on power. They got close to losing it because it was just about to fall apart before the United States threw them a lifeline in 2014. Just like we did with Iran, coming out on the wrong side once again. Andrew Roberts says there's a great sickness at the heart of Western society when its leaders either cannot or will not denounce evil when it sees it. It is an unmistakable sign of decadent, disastrous cultural self-hatred when prominent leaders of democratic countries cannot state openly that evil dictators such as the late President Fidel Castro of Cuba were what they were undoubtedly: serial human rights abusers, torturers, and tyrants. That's what he was. And yet you have the worst that they can say, like you just heard from Jeremy Corbyn, is that, well, there were some problems. There were a few problems. There were some excesses. And I've spoken out about those. But what a leader. What a leader. Look at what he did for healthcare and for education. Andrew Roberts says here, it's even worse when they hide behind statistics for literacy or healthcare that they must know have been hugely exaggerated and in some cases entirely invented by governments wholly in the hands of a Marxist, Leninist nomenclatura that says, unlike so much in modern politics, our collective response to the death of Fidel Castro is indeed a moral issue. He says it's a test that all too many leaders, former leaders and would-be Western leaders, have failed woefully. Here is a man whose henchmen have, according to Amnesty International, arrested and detained 8,600 people on political grounds in the last year alone. That's just this year. Forget about 1959 or 1964 or 1971. We're talking about 2016. Arresting 8,600 political dissidents. What about all the ones that have been shot over the years? No room for dissent in Cuba, that's for sure. It says, yet who have been lauded in the mainstream media, both liberal and, much worse, conservative. That's what Andrew Roberts says here. It's worse when you see the conservative side not speaking out. But they won't do it. They won't tell you what kind of a vicious dictator this really was. He goes on in this piece, Mr. Roberts, quoting from all these Western officials, these Western leaders, Jean-Claude Juncker from the EU, just with all these glowing terms about the former Cuban president, condolences to his family, praise for the Cuban people. He quotes Jimmy Carter, a statement here about all the wonderful things Castro did. Andrew Roberts says, but someone who genuinely loved his country rather than just power and the sound of his own voice would not have led it to the kind of penury that made rationing necessary since the supplies booklet system was imposed in 1962. So much poverty and suffering, so much animosity among the Cuban people, so many of them that wanted to get out of Cuba. It quotes from the French president, Hollande, who, like all the others, talked about this revolutionary leader. And then the Canadian Prime Minister, the President of the United States, Jeremy Corbyn, Ken Livingston, the former London mayor, who called this individual a beacon of light. It says here, for Ken Livingston, this monster, Castro, who ran his country into the ground to the point that today the average wage is £15 a month, was a beacon of light. Ken Livingstone says he was a beacon of light. He just ran his country into the ground. And the average wage is £15 a month, where they have all of this supposed wonderful health care and education. And it's like they're living. Economically, it's like they're living back in the 1920s or 30s. It says, but at least Corbyn and Livingston are on the far left, where Castro is worshipped for his ideological anti-Americanism. See, that's really what it boils down to for those on the left. It's this cultural self-hatred, as he says at the start of his at the start of his piece. They really love the fact that he was radically anti-American. And so you can expect it coming from those on the left. But as Andrew Roberts says here at the end, yet so far there's not been a peep out of Angela Merkel or Theresa May. No public statements whatsoever from either of them. That's what makes one long for the days when we had leaders with a strong moral compass. Who can doubt what Ronald Reagan and Margaret Thatcher would have said about the death of Castro? A single sentence from either of them would have had more clarity and human decency than all the apologies, appeasement, and silence from the rest of today's so-called leaders put together. Yes, who can doubt what President Ronald Reagan would say if he were here today? Imagine what he would have said about Castro's death. This clip that we'll play for you here, it actually comes from 1975. This is several years before Ronald Reagan became president, when he lost his bid for the presidency in the 1976 election. He had a short radio show that played each day. I think it was just 3-4 minutes a day. But this comes from one of his programs in 1975, and this is what at the time, this is what President Reagan had to say about Cuba and the Castro regime.
Not too long ago on this program, I discussed Cuba and gave some requirements I thought should be met before Uncle Sam welcomed that unhappy island back into the family of American nations. Now, that was an editorial, an expression of opinion with which you could agree or disagree. Since then, one of our TV networks has presented, with a certain amount of fanfare, a, quote, documentary, unquote, and question mark. It was called Cuba, the People. Was it really a documentary, or was it an editorial? Basically, the message was that soon Cuba will no longer be an underdeveloped country thanks to the success of socialism. The question is, how and when did Cuba become an underdeveloped country? Prior to Castro, Cuba led all its Latin neighbors in standard of living, literacy, and any number of other desirable indicators. For example, Cuba had more doctors in proportion to population, more automobiles, higher per capita income, more TV broadcasting and ownership of TV sets, more newspaper circulation, and even greater attendance at movies. In moviegoing, they were second only to us, which means they were second in the world. The so-called documentary was of Cuba today. It showed farmers plowing with oxen. Now, I don't know how widespread that is, but mechanized farming had reached a pretty high level back in Cuba, B.C., before Castro. Let me read some lines from what has to be considered a real documentary. A report issued in May 1962 by the Economic Research Service of the U.S. Department of Agriculture. The report was entitled, Agriculture and Food Situation in Cuba. Quote, in 1958, Cuba was self-supporting in many foodstuffs such as meat, poultry, fish, eggs, milk, butter, tubers, vegetables, coffee, and fruits, of which there was a great variety and abundance. In the season, oranges were sold in pushcarts in Havana, peeled, iced, and ready to eat at 3, 4, or 5 for a nickel. Under communism, food ration cards were introduced before the third year of the revolution expired. Oranges have become so scarce that they can only be purchased in pharmacies with a doctor's prescription. Unquote. I don't know whether the makers of the documentary intended to sell us socialism or whether they were just set up by their Cuban hosts, but a truly objective documentary would have made it plain that the Cuba of today is not anywhere near as well off or economically sound as it was before Castro imposed communism on the people. Indeed, there's every reason to believe Cuba would be in real trouble without the sizable subsidy it gets from the Soviet Union. These days, when we're flooded with so many words on every subject, we need to check out some of those words before we accept them as gospel.
That's Ronald Reagan from 1975, just giving the basic and simple truth about Cuba being so much worse off since the Castro regime came to power. In every respect, Cuba was made worse under the rule of Fidel Castro. And it is, as Reagan said in 1975, to this day, an unhappy island. And you'll note that Reagan took aim in that short broadcast at the mainstream media that was out there saying that, look, the success of socialism is going to turn it around for Cuba. Now, who was proven right in the end? Well, if you just go by the words that you hear today coming from the left wing, you would assume that Cuba is just this wonderful utopia. But what is the truth? It shows just how far a communist is willing to go to lie and deceive for the sake of the agenda. It's all about the agenda. Never mind the facts, never mind what's happening on the ground. And if not for that sizable subsidy, as Reagan said in 75, coming from Russia or the Soviet Union at the time, well, it would have collapsed long ago. It was about to in 2014. And now you've got the sizable subsidy coming in from the United States of America. Now you've got normalized relations between the United States and Cuba. And the sizable subsidy that's propped up the Cuban dictator's brother's regime, Raul Castro, even as he continues to arrest political dissidents and even kill them. Even as so many of the Cuban people are living in poverty-stricken conditions. How many are out there just giving you the truth? The truth about that administration. Was it really serving the people of Cuba? And what does it say about the United States and Britain when our leaders rush to the microphone to say how great Fidel Castro was? It shows just how weak we are. Last week I gave a program. We have forgotten God. We have forgotten God. And I went through that passage, as I say, in Leviticus 26, where God says, If you will not yet for all this hearken to me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins. And I explained last Wednesday that has to do with the duration of the curse, that 2,520-year delay to our people's receiving the blessings God promised to Abraham. Well, once God fulfilled that promise and poured down all of these blessings of prosperity and power, beginning around 1800, both with Great Britain and the United States, then it was on us to hold on to those blessings, to hold on to that power. But what have we done? Well, we've forgotten God, as I said last Wednesday. And God says in that same passage, we didn't have time last Wednesday to go through some of those verses that talk about the curses that would set in. But God says in Leviticus 26 and verse 19, I'll break the pride of your power. That's what's happening. There's still some power there. But we've lost the pride that we once had in that power. And it's because of this sickness from within. It's because of this rottenness on the inside. If you back up in that passage, Leviticus 26, starting in verse 14, let me just read a few verses for you. But it says here, if you will not hearken to me and will not do all these commandments, and if you shall despise my statutes, or if your soul abhors my judgments, so that you will not do all my commandments, but that you break my commandment, God says, I also will do this unto you. I'll even appoint over you terror, consumption, and the burning ague that shall consume the eyes and cause sorrow of the heart, and shall sow your seed in vain. You shall sow your seed in vain, it says, for your enemies shall eat it. God talks about terrorism. He talks about being afraid. And then he says in verse 17, "And I'll set my face against you, and you shall be slain before your enemies. And they that hate you shall reign over you." It's an interesting verse, verse 17 of Leviticus 26. They that hate you are going to rule over you. Now, ultimately, this is talking about our peoples being made slaves and our slave masters ruling over us. But even before that, if you think about the message in America Under Attack, an Antiochus-type figure leading the United States of America, or others in Canada, in the UK. Look at so many of the leaders presiding over the nations of Israel today, and consider this disastrous, decadent, cultural self-hatred that Andrew Roberts talks about in his Telegraph piece this morning. Self-hatred. They that hate you shall reign over you. That's what we're seeing in so many sectors of our society. Turning a blind eye to all of the serial human rights abuse, all of the torture, all of the murder. That's what's happening. You've got to come to thetrumpet.com, or you've got to go to the writings of Herbert Armstrong and maybe just a few commentators today to get the truth. To get the truth. We have this quote, and he was right. This is from Herbert Armstrong in 1956. Again, it's from that chapter about the communist infiltration of America. It was prophesied. It was prophesied. Mr. Armstrong talked about it. This from 1956. What we fail to grasp in the struggle with Russia is this. We're not fighting a single nation in a military war, but a gigantic, worldwide, plainclothes army masquerading as a political party, seeking to conquer the world with an entirely new kind of warfare. It's a kind of warfare we don't understand or know how to cope with. It uses every diabolical means to weaken us from within, sapping our strength, perverting our morals, sabotaging our educational system, wrecking our social structure, destroying our spiritual and religious life, weakening our industrial and economic power, demoralizing our armed forces, and finally, after such infiltration, overthrowing our government by force and violence. All this cleverly disguised as a harmless political party. See, Fidel Castro, just a harmless political party that was serving over the Cuban people for so many decades. And you see the weakness and the sickness from within. You see it in the statements from Western leaders, how that our strength has been sapped, how that our morals have been perverted, how our educational system has been sabotaged from within, the social structure has been wrecked, spiritual and religious life destroyed. Mr. Armstrong, in that same article, or in those writings from the 1950s and 60s, where he was warning about this communist infiltration, he talked about passages like Hosea 7, verses 8 through 13, about what would happen ultimately when our peoples got mixed up with the ideologies of foreign nations, foreign influence. He talked about what would happen if we go out and seek alliances with other nations, if we forsake God or forget God and seek to ally our thinking with other nations. He said, this is going to eat away at your strength, America. It's going to eat away at your strength, Britain. And has that happened? Well, the communist infiltration of America, it was prophesied. And he was right. We write, history and current events have since shown that America's dalliance with Russian-style communism has perverted its morals, weakened its economic power, and eaten away its strength. This is a tragic story, but America was warned. America was warned about this in the strongest possible way back in the 1950s and 60s. And now look at where we are today. And now look at some of these statements coming out from Western leaders about this so-called great leader. Legendary. Remarkable. That's what you see or hear Western leaders saying today. Another piece here highlighting some of this upside-down thinking from The Spectator in the UK. It says, why are left-wing dictators always treated with more reverential respect when they die than right-wing ones? Even on the right. Even on the right. Even those commenting on the right. Here are these left-wing dictators, these monsters, these tyrants, and they're just revered now as if nothing happened, as if none of those atrocities ever really happened. Well, the Spectator points to, again, all the human rights violations, the 8,600 politically motivated detentions, activists being put in jail, being put in prison. And yet, despite this, as The Spectator notes, The Guardian announced that, quote, the revolutionary icon, one of the world's best known and most controversial leaders, survived countless U.S. assassination attempts. The U.S. is the bad guy. And premature obituaries, but in the end, proved mortal. You know, he died in the end. This revolutionary icon. He finally did die. And it says in its 11th paragraph, it mentioned concerns over human rights under the Castro regime. But only insofar as they were mentioned by François Hollande rather than the paper itself. Well, it was just the French leader that mentioned it. And that's the only way it got its way into the Guardian. It says any reader would have been forgiven for thinking that Castro was controversial, not for his vicious dictatorship and use of torture, but simply because the CIA didn't like his Marxism-Leninism. Any reader could be forgiven for thinking this, given the coverage, the glowing coverage. He says here, the Telegraph, disgracefully for a conservative newspaper, also headlined their obituary, Revolutionary Hero, and stated at home he swept away capitalism and won support for bringing schools and hospitals to the poor. But he also created legions of enemies and critics, concentrated among Cuban exiles in Miami, who fled his rule and saw him as a ruthless tyrant. And then The Spectator says here, that implies that the Cubans living in Cuba itself loved him for his health care and educational reforms rather than secretly hating him for keeping their island living in the 1960s. It says, finally, Fidel Castro was a foul tyrant, and his brother Raul is no better. Free Western media outlets ought to have said so right at the top of their news reports instead of admitting it towards the end like it's some uncomfortable detail. Well, when you look at the way Mr. Armstrong or my father has talked about it, here again, you get the truth. You get the truth. I found this quote from one of Mr. Armstrong's old coworker letters, and he's just talking about getting his program on a particular radio station that I think it reached into Cuba, and he just made this comment in passing about Cuba. These two giant communist anti-God dictatorships now have a little junior edition dictator. He's talking about the Soviet Union. They now have a little junior edition dictatorship right on the United States doorstep. Castro's Cuba. This is from 1960. Mr. Armstrong says, Castro has been confiscating and taking over all American industry in Cuba. He's trying to shut out everything American and everything Christian. That was what was happening in 1960, and Mr. Armstrong said it straight up. And what do we see happening today? Even today, to the tune of 8,600. That's the best estimate that we can come up with. Political dissidents, those that would disagree with the Castro regime, locked up, put in prison, put in jail. That's the way it works. You'd think that the free Western media would, right at the top of their broadcast, right at the top of their article, would come forward with all of these abuses. Instead, it's just treated like some little uncomfortable detail tacked on at the very end of the piece. Ted Cruz, the candidate for president earlier this year, his family is of Cuban descent. He had a piece at National Review yesterday saying now that he's died, the race is on to see which world leader can most fulsomely praise Fidel Castro's legacy while delicately averting their eyes from his less savory characteristics. He too talks about what President Obama said over the weekend, what Justin Trudeau said over the weekend. And then Ted Cruz weighs in later on, saying, with all due respect to Mr. Obama, the 60 years Fidel Castro spent systematically exploiting and oppressing the people of Cuba provide more than enough history to pass judgment on both Fidel and now, more importantly, his brother, Raul. He gives a couple of examples. Those that have tried to flee the country, and how that these two informed him that Cuba was to the point of collapse in 2013. Well, let me just read it for you. It says, consider, for example, the dissidents Guillermo Farinas and Elizardo Sanchez, who warned me, this is Ted Cruz writing, who warned me in the summer of 2013 that the Castros, then on the ropes because of the reduction of Venezuelan patronage, were plotting to cement their hold on power by pretending to liberalize in order to get the American economic embargo lifted. Their model was Vladimir Putin's consolidation of power in Russia. And their plan was to get the United States to pay for it. It worked, Ted Cruz says. It worked. Here they were just about to collapse economically. And so they pretended. They pretended to liberalize in order to get the United States of America to lift the economic embargo, to get the United States of America to effectively throw it a lifeline. And the plan worked. Here's what President Obama said back in 2014.
Today, the United States of America is changing its relationship with the people of Cuba. In the most significant changes in our policy in more than 50 years, we will end an outdated approach that for decades has failed to advance our interests, and instead, we will begin to normalize relations between our two countries. Through these changes, we intend to create more opportunities for the American and Cuban people and begin a new chapter among the nations of the Americas.
That's President Obama from December 2014, talking about the new chapter, effectively lifting the economic embargo, no matter the human rights abuses, no matter the abuse of the Cuban people. Now it just gives added strength and power to the Castro regime. Well, Ted Cruz, in his piece, talks about how there haven't been very good signs leading up to Fidel Castro's death. that Raul was going to loosen his grip on power. He says Raul is not a different Castro. He is his brother's chosen successor, who has spent the last 8 years implementing his dynastic plan. Unlike Cuba, however, the United States has an actual democracy, and our recent elections suggest there is a significant resistance among the American people to the Obama administration's policy of appeasement towards hostile dictators. We can and should send clear signals that the policy is at an end. This policy to restore diplomatic relations with Cuba, to lift the economic embargo. Well, Cruz concludes his piece by just saying that, you know, there is a way to apply pressure and so on and so forth, but as I just read there, he's talking about the recent elections. The recent election in the United States. Which brings me back to Donald Trump. As I said at the top, I mean, here he is seen in the West. Here he is seen by so many on the left as such a dangerous figure and one that's obviously unfit for office. And yet, who is it that comes out with the strongest response over the weekend to Fidel Castro's death? He called him a brutal dictator who oppressed his own people for nearly six decades. Here it's Donald Trump, who's closer to the truth than all the others. And by no means is he a staunch conservative. But on this, you have to give him credit. Fidel Castro's legacy is one of firing squads, theft, unimaginable suffering, poverty, and the denial of fundamental human rights. See, we've talked about a fair bit of this. Even recently at thetrumpet.com, just because of the United States extending its hand to Cuba, beginning back in December of 2014. We had a lot to say about it in 2015 when the deal was made final to finish what Mr. Trump said in his statement. While Cuba remains a totalitarian island, it's my hope that today marks a move away from the horrors endured for so long and toward a future in which the wonderful Cuban people finally live in the freedom they so richly deserve. Well, this whole world needs a new government, because none of them have worked, but certainly not communism. Certainly not. And you can see the desperate need for truth in all of this. It shows the weakness, as I said earlier, but it also shows just how truth is the first casualty in warfare, as has been often said. And so many of these leaders coming forward to not give you the truth, to not tell you the truth about this even recent history, but are quite happy to tell lies and to spread deceit, all in the name of their radical agenda. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. When we come back here in a minute or two, we'll tie up a few loose ends before we conclude today's program. We'll be right back.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is the Trumpet Daily. Are we living in the last days? Some dismiss the notion as fanatical, but world leaders and news analysts are issuing warnings that are becoming more and more dire. Could Bible prophecies about the last days actually be accurate? Our brochure can help guide you through the relevant news and history and help you compare these events to what the Bible says. Are we living in the last days? This brochure is available for free right now at thetrumpet.com. The Trumpet Daily Radio Show airs every morning at 7 a.m. Central Time on KPCG 101.3 FM in Edmond, Oklahoma.
Well, over the weekend in the United States, they celebrated the Thanksgiving holiday last Thursday, and quite a few people, of course, have that time off work. We were able to take a little bit of time off as well. We did record another TV program that we hope to send out this week based upon that radio show we did last Wednesday about Americans having forgotten God. So that will go out this week and will be played hopefully the following weekend. But over the course of this past weekend, my family and I were able to see the Birmingham Symphony Hall for the first time. As I was telling the students this morning in class, you know, nothing against Birmingham. It's an old industrial city in many ways, a big city. There's a lot about Birmingham not to like, but this particular part of the city downtown, the theater district, the concert district, and such, was actually fairly nice. And the Symphony Hall was gorgeous as well, really good acoustics, and the Birmingham Symphony also did a fine job with a couple of its performances of Beethoven. So that we saw, and everything about it too, is quite a lot cheaper than going into London for a show, including the parking. So that's something to keep in mind if you live in the Midlands, that there's quite a lot that Birmingham has to offer. And also Coventry, a fairly big city. Again, speaking of an industrial city, Coventry is not far from Birmingham, just 10, 15 miles or so. And on Thursday evening, things are open over here on Thursdays, on Thanksgiving Day, because they don't have Thanksgiving, at least not on the day that Americans observe it. And so everything was open, and so we went to the Coventry Transport Museum, which I do want to spend some time on in a later program, because as I tweeted out the night that I was there, you really do get just a wonderful, well, I guess I shouldn't say wonderful, but a pretty vivid lesson from the United States and Britain in prophecy, a tragic history in so many ways. As you go through this incredible museum that has so much on display, the synopsis from its program says this: the last 150 years of Coventry's history has been shaped in part by the rise and fall of its motor and cycle industries, the rise and the fall, and both are on display. The rise, as it happens, is there at the in the first half, the first two-thirds of the museum. And then you see the fall thereafter. It says, in this time, this 150-year period, around 475 bicycle and tricycle makers, 161 car manufacturers, and 116 motorcycle manufacturers have operated in the city, touching the lives of millions of people. Coventry was just bombed to smithereens in World War II, and the reason for this is because of what I just read there. All of this manufacturing, all of these cars and motorcycles that were coming out of the city, and Hitler knew it and wanted to get rid of them. Because as soon as the war set in, well, you had all these car factories that then started to produce military vehicles. And the same was true in the United States. These industrial powerhouses, these manufacturing powerhouses at the time, and Hitler's war machine couldn't keep up with it. The industrial might of the United States and Britain. The rise and the fall, though, of the motor and cycle industries. And you go through some of those exhibits later on in the museum, and you hear narrators talking as if it's just inevitable. You know, you reach the high water mark, and then there's really nowhere to go but down from there. And you have the emergence of the Japanese markets, the German markets. And of course, we're not producing in Coventry like we once did. They don't even manufacture cars there anymore. You go back to the early 1950s, and Britain was second to the United States in automobile manufacturing. Pretty amazing. The synopsis here says, today, Coventry Transport Museum traces the paths of these industries through massive social change and momentous world events. It tells the fascinating story of the city, its inhabitants, and their phenomenal achievements from the very first bicycles to world record-breaking cars. It's free getting into that museum. There's so much history in the UK. That's one of the joys of living here, because it's on display. The United States and Britain in prophecy in so many ways. It's on full display here in the UK. You can see it. You can see the message of the United States and Britain in prophecy in so many of these museums, in so many of these sites, all across Britain. One of them is just right down the road from us in Coventry, about 20 miles or so from Edstone. Well, the program that played on TV this past weekend, the U.S. election and Europe's new geopolitical order. We were a little concerned with this content that it would meet with the station's approval, as they typically don't care for our commentary on politics, world leaders, and that kind of thing. In any event, it went through just fine. And this is the first time that we offered Great Again. We offered it along with He Was Right, and it brought in 188 requests, which is one of the highest responses we've gotten in several weeks, several months maybe. I took 14 calls myself. We had our students gallivanting around Europe and elsewhere during the break. So it was great for me to be able to talk to some of the viewers. Quite a few of the 14 just requested Great Again because they said they already had He Was Right. So these are repeat callers that are obviously watching the program regularly and saw that we were offering something new and called in for Great Again. 188 requests. So with the residual requests coming in these next several days, we might even top out at 200 or so. We'll see. Well, that's all that we have time for today, unfortunately. You're listening to Stephen Fleury, and this is the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. Don't forget to email us this week. Keep those emails coming in at td@kpcg.fm. Thank you for joining us today. We'll see you tomorrow.